broadcasting from the University City.
We are Cambridge 105.
I quite like baked apples in the winter.
There's no fancy pants stuff in there. It's just proper English pork and it's lovely.
It's just a real sort of hubbub of stuff happening.
Do you remember I bought some chickens?
That's right.
That's when we started to sell eggs.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's where it really started.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
Yeah.
Why did you become a butcher?
It was fun. I was at a friend's house once and I was helping her dad cut up a bit of venison. I didn't even know what I was doing, but I just knew I enjoyed it. Now I can do it properly.
We don't stint on the smoked salmon.
Well,
I don't. God.
It's 12 noon, it's lunchtime, and it's time for Flavour, your food and drink programme for Cambridge. And today marks our 10th anniversary. That is 10 years of scouring the city and beyond for everything Epicurean and interesting. And as ever, thanks to Ian Dayborn for 2 hours of wonderful Saturday morning music. I'm Matt Bentman.
I'm Alan Alder, fresh from my holidays. And today we have a new studio guest joining us, Rosie Applin from the Bums on Seats team.
Thank you, Alan. It's lovely to be here. On today's programme, we have a review of the latest cookbooks, courtesy of Sarah Lavelle from Quadril Publishing.
Alice Archer from the Cambridge Wine Merchants returns to champion rosé wine.
And speaking of wine, have you ever considered a wine and tapas evening as a complete night out? Well, I went to a night hosted by Estefania Led Ramos of Querico Tapas Spanish Cuisine. It was a properly, truly authentic evening.
And Nazima Pathan discusses apricots in her latest feature on food pairings, suggesting different ways to cook them and interesting partners to pair them with. In addition, we'll catch up with recent tweets and bring you the latest food and drink news from the city.
So, to begin, Flavour's 10 years old, and you and I are the longer-serving members, Matt.
Yeah.
We didn't start the programme.
No, we didn't. That distinction goes to Elaine Cusack. She describes herself as a nosy journalist and a community radio buff. Now, Elaine was the sole producer of the monthly programme, as it was then, but it's always been a live production. So I met with Elaine for the first time in years this week, over at the CB2 Cafe. That's where we used to hold our regular Flavour production meetings. So I thought I'd ask her, why is it that Flavour has always been live?
Well, why ever not? Because we're radio pioneers and we have to get in the saddle and we have to turn on those knobs and we have to wait for the do, bum, 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 bum. Bum, 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 bum. Of course we had to do it live. There was all that. It could never be anything else, Matt.
Yeah. July the 7th, 2007.
Hello and welcome to the first edition of Flavour of the Month, 209 Radio's one and only show dedicated to food and drink. My name's Elaine Cusack and I want to tell you a little bit about the show and what you can expect to hear today and in future programmes.
I'm a writer and I started writing poetry when I was 15 and then I fell into journalism after school, mostly print journalism, a little bit of broadcast journalism. You know, I did the odd bit of things with BBC and stuff, but I discovered a passion for community radio, so I spent a long time, like up to 5 years, working and managing Charing Cross Hospital's radio station, and I was involved in a few RSLs, restricted service licence stations, also oral history projects I used to be involved in. And so I brought all that to Flavour of the Month. And I like to think of it as a sort of part oral history, part magazine programme.
Do you remember how it was putting that first show together?
I do. It wasn't nerve-wracking, and the actual recording was nerve-wracking. Putting it together was a joy because it was the equivalent of putting together a magazine by myself.
Yeah.
With all the different features, the front page, well, you know, of course the script. I drafted and redrafted it, tried to get it perfect, ran it back past the station manager, and that was interesting. But as well, I thought, well, where do I begin? You know, where do I begin with it? So I started with Dave Fox from the Trumpington Allotment Society because I knew him.
So the idea is the sweet corn grows up and makes lovely corn on the cob in August and September, and the pumpkins grow more horizontally and they'll help to cover the ground and conserve moisture there. So that's an example of interplanting, and hopefully it's going to work.
And Susie Oakes, the late lamented Susie, very much involved in the Mill Road Winter Fair and a community-minded person.
The Winter Fair, the first one was in 2005, we had about 8,000 people, and we have a very small budget for what is quite a large event because we run it the whole mile of Mill Road.
So I had Dave Fox and Susie Oakes in the first show, and I also had my mum and dad, because I wanted to... I didn't want the show to be all about me, but I certainly felt for the first one I had to introduce myself, sell myself a little bit, and I thought I would do that by introducing two wonderful people, my dad and my mum. And it's poignant now to listen back to it as they talk about panacalty, which is a northeast dish.
Panacalty, or as my mother used to call it, was titty pot. It was usually made from the leftover beef from the Sunday, made for a Monday evening meal after washing day, when it was easy meal to make.
Because my dad sadly died in 2009, and my mum, bless her, has got advanced dementia. But you know what, I went to visit her 2 days ago, and I said, Mum, do you remember when you were on my first radio show? And she said, yes.
Panacalty pan, because it was cooked in a pan on top of the oven. Everything was put in, easy to make, in a pan. Accolty, everything. That's the way I think of it.
She said yes across the room, and the carers went, your mum's just, she just answered your question. I was really pleased. So I might take it back in and play it to her to see. It's quite interesting. So it's lovely to have that.
Yeah.
All of the various people that have worked on Flavour. Louise came in 2008, right?
Right, now I'm going to bring the microphones up here. And welcome on board. Louise, where do you hail from? Is your home a little bit further up north?
Whizbeach, the Fens.
What are your sort of foodie childhood memories then?
It was baking. It was going to my nan's house on a Sunday. There was a track near her house and it was just full of blackberries and gooseberries. We'd make mince pies, jam tarts and cakes, and it was special. It was something to look forward to.
She took over as producer when you left, along with Helen Dyson as a contributor.
Do you think that these street parties are important for the community?
Oh, absolutely. I've got my French lodger. My father-in-law has just come over from Java 24 hours ago, and he doesn't speak English. This is his first introduction to our country, and it's a pretty cosmopolitan event, really.
Claire Kane. Yes.
Let's start with a couple that you recommend for seasoned whiskey drinkers that may be a good choice for Burns Nights.
Absolutely. So we've got Talisker 18 year here. This is very, very old, very, very rich. It's an island whiskey. So if you imagine that all the soil where the grains have been growing, it's got rotting seaweed in there. So it's very, very salty.
And Claire stayed with us for about 4 or 5 months before she moved down to London to go and study a journalism course, I think. And then we had Ed Latter. He turned up, he was a chef. And I just felt he really hit the ground running. He interviewed up at the Gogmagog Hills farm shop.
So this is Clive and Philip, the turkeys we were talking about earlier.
Clive and Philip, but they're still ruling the roost.
They have a tendency to guard the door to the shop so people can't come in, which is probably not the best business sense.
And he did a fantastic job. The sad thing was, he only stayed with us for about 6 months, maybe less, before he moved off. It sounds really exotic, but he went to work as a private chef on, I think it was on a Caribbean island, for someone very famous.
I've got one Boris, who always takes the food dish up to the furthest point of the field and hides it.
It's her. She's
naughty. She's a redhead, you see.
Dodgy.
And then there was Nick.
I'm delighted to welcome fellow volunteer Nick Stibbs to the show. Yeah.
So, I mean, are you from Cambridge then, Nick?
I am, yeah.
Cambridge, yes. Born and bred. So you are...
Millwright Hospital.
Thanks. Oh, my goodness. Oh, well, you are our only Cambridge born and bred person. So you need to tell us about what are the sort of places that you like to go to in Cambridge?
Where I'd like to go to, if I'm taken out...
it's different to where you do go to, then, as I was saying.
And yeah, like you said, I wanted to learn to do the engineering so that you guys would be free to do more of what you wanted to do. And things just evolved from there.
Because I could tell you had a wicked sense of humour, and you also had a great radio voice, and so it just made sense for you to get in front of the microphone as well as standing behind it. So
I think for the last 7 years, I haven't personally interviewed anybody in the studio because I love being out and about. That's the very reason, that's why we're called a community station, is to be out in the community. And that's what's so cool. All of those sound effects, all of those nuances. People are so much more relaxed if you get to meet them on their home ground.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
And then Alan joined, of course, in January 2011.
One of the descriptors of Sauvignon Blanc is often cat's pee on a gooseberry bush. Can anybody find cat's pee or a gooseberry bush in this? I'm not sure the side.
Luckily, I happen to have two with me.
I feel like Alan is very much the driving force behind flavour, and he has been for a long time, because he's got so much energy for it, he's got so much time for it, and he really works his guts out as well.
And Ruth Reyes joined us in 2012.
And what attracted you to working on flavour?
It just sounds like really good fun. I mean, I love food and I can talk about it for hours on end, just ask my friends. It's nice to have an outlet for it. Promoting local food community and generally just getting excited about food in any way is exactly what I want to be spending my time.
But when you think about it, 10 years, that's a heck of a lot of pre-records, heck of a lot of people that we've interviewed. Some people are no longer with us. Some people have moved out of Cambridge. Some people are still thriving. It's like an audio tapestry of Cambridge. Get your ears round this. Listen to this.
Fizz is a good wine to have in, isn't it?
It's always a good one to start with, isn't it, I think?
Hairs on your chest.
And I started cooking them on a double gas ring in the lab.
Let's just talk about street food for a moment, because that's something that's sort of really flourishing in Cambridge.
We've got soy stuff as well.
Soy stuff.
We've got soy butter.
Soy butter. Yeah.
If they like you and they recommend you, that's better than a bunch of Frenchmen coming in and marking how my tablecloths are folded.
Yeah, OK, fair enough.
That's quite grippy, isn't it, on the finish?
Bueno.
Oh, no, this has all gone wrong. Right, this fire alarm's going to go off again in a second.
I'm trying to think what it is.
Oh, no!
I just don't care. If people say, you should really do it this way, I say, no, I'm doing it this way, the way I like it.
Mill Road basements are the best.
You could use a good local honey, like the Fenland honey.
Rosie the chef and I, we're mildly perverse.
I'm actually going to use 60 mils of gin. Oops.
Cam Mines Allotment Group certainly knows its onions when it comes to growing vegetables.
How many puns? How many? Yes, it was lovely, Elaine.
Two Scotch eggs. Philip! Okay.
But it really brings out the best of Stilton and the best of ice cream, really.
How do you rank the colour of a wine?
Pull up a chair, have a coffee.
Now, you don't have to have three helpings of everything, you know.
On allotments, you go past allotments and there's always raspberries. It's always raspberries.
The Chanterelle. I love its colour, its smell. I love to eat it.
What's she eating? What's that? And Clara told me it's a bird's head.
Yeah.
Buy one for bedtime and one for the kitchen, and that's by none other than the great lady herself, Delia Smith.
So, yeah, we got to have a celebration.
You're not recording, are you?
No.
Oh,
sorry,
No, he says.
Because every wine sort of tells a story.
I like, you know, seeing people smile when you give them a sandwich. I worked in software and people don't smile when you give them software.
So why is it called Pickle Pig Cider?
Well, the pigs you heard in that piece get to eat the apple pulp from the cider-making process. Sometimes it's fermented, therefore Charles will then end up with tipsy pigs.
But yeah, I'm quite in control behind my counter. I feel safe here, even with a microphone.
The thing is, Matt, the chickens he was using had been to the chicken method acting school.
Yeah. I've always said my gravestone will bear the famous inscription, a life without cheese is a life half lived.
There's certain things that you have to be very, very quick, where, you know, it comes out of the kitchen, you've got a chef running across the restaurant, and people look at you thinking, this guy must be insane, he's just going to go and photograph. And then you stand up on a table in the middle of a restaurant to photograph something.
That was made for radio.
You're good.
When I first said to you that I want to come to Flavour, I want to join the programme so that I can learn about food and I can learn about engineering, and it's a win-win. And then what I found over time, quite quickly, was that it's about the stories. It's the stories that entertain me. I love those stories, just like I love listening to John Peel on Home Truths. He was my high watermark of quality radio, and I always aspire to reach that, because it's important, you know. We've got this privilege to do the radio that we do, and it shouldn't be done in a half-hearted way. Give it your all, you know, give it style, let it have the space to breathe. I don't think that's too arty, I think that's spot on.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. It's not about the flavour of the food and the drink that we're talking about. It's the flavour and the strength of the stories.
Yeah.
It's always about people.
When you listen to that first episode and I can hear what's in your voice is in our voices now. And that is it. You know, you have to have that desire, not just to broadcast, but
the desire to be a storyteller, I suppose.
Thank you very much. It's very flattering of you to say that, and I'm glad. I mean, I do think the show's evolved, but it's nice of you to say that you can still see the link between the two. I can, but you can maybe hear it more than I can.
Flavour. It's a complicated show to put together, but you know, at the top of our paperwork, even to this day, is Elaine's mantra, smile, it sounds better. And there's lots of little things like that, you know, which helps keep us on track. And your time here on Flavour, Alan?
I'm enjoying it enormously. And when I miss a programme, like I missed the last one because I was away, I'm always sorry about it. But I suppose one of the things that strikes me, and in fact everybody who sits back and thinks about food in Cambridge, is how much the food scene has changed in the last 10 years.
Certainly,
you know,
yeah.
The number of new places, in fact, almost all the places we talk about on Flavour have opened in the last 10 years, haven't they?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, things like Jack's Gelato, Steak and Honour, Aromi, Afternoon Teas, Fitzbillies, okay, it was there, but it's reopened and re-energised. Hot Numbers, Pint Shop, Novi. I mean, there have been some fatalities along the way, most recently Inda's Kitchen. But it is such a vibrant scene, and you wonder where it's going to go next. And the optimist in me, and I am optimistic, is there's going to be more, even better, more exciting, if that's possible, independent producers. But I have a slight sort of, slightly anxious feel that maybe people will become stale and open up more branches and the quality will drop. There's no sign of that. I mean, Hot Numbers has opened another branch and the quality certainly has not dropped. But I just hope that doesn't happen. I don't think it will.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny, you know, 10 years and we're still finding plenty of stories out and about there to report on. It's not like we have a run dry.
Yeah.
That's a really good thing. And also, I think, you know, technology has gone hand in hand with the food scene over the last 7 to 10 years as well. We've been able to take advantage of amazing, well, the vendors have been able to take advantage of amazing things like Twitter, free advertising. I always think, you know, my parents used to run a motorcycle shop. If they were able, back then in the 80s, to tweet all of their individual customers to say, hey, this new crash helmet's in, come in at 5 on Friday and check it out. You know, the grassroots power you've got there, and it's free.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And they do that, and they take advantage, and it works really well. Really, really well. Anyway, on to our next feature. Rosie.
Well, it's time to catch up now with publishing director Sarah Lavelle of Quadrille, who met up with Alan to discuss the latest collection of on-trend cooking titles.
Sarah, got some new cookbooks with you. One I really liked, actually, which is by Jackson and Levine, and it's called Round 2 Hours.
It is.
And Jackson and Levine?
Well, Jackson and Levine are, in fact, Laura Jackson and Alice Levine. They both have extremely successful media careers. Alice is a Radio 1 DJ and Laura is a TV presenter. And quite aside from their media careers, they run a supper club under the name Jackson and Levine. And that's how I became aware of what they were up to. These supper clubs sold out in minutes as soon as they announced them via social media. So I met up with them and they were an absolute delight and very keen to do a book. So we sort of worked on what it would be, because how you translate a supper club into a cookbook. And they came up with this brilliant idea of it being menus. So it's all organised by menus for various types of occasion. And they're just so adept and good at styling their evenings and just beautiful spaces, just using very, very sort of simple.
So they've sort of learned from their supper club experience how you can entertain friends, family, get-togethers.
Absolutely. They say it's as much about the styling, those little finishing touches, as about the food itself, and that's what people remember.
Yes, because they got things in there like the plates, the glasses, the place settings, flowers, lighting, haven't
they? That's right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the flowers particularly are just beautiful. They use them as little sort of placeholders or name holders, and they have lots of tips about things like that. For instance, they say you could get cheap IKEA tea towels, make amazing napkins if you just fold them up, and they say that's one of the things they get asked about a lot. And just picking up bits and bobs of vintage crockery and jumble sales.
Yeah.
They just have loads of really great ideas, as you say, for styling as well as the food.
Yeah. But it's also interesting that they are celebrities in their in their way, but it's not a celebrity cookbook, is it? They are actually interested in food.
No, they really are. And that's one thing that was really key from the beginning. They are passionate about food and they wanted to communicate a really positive and healthy message about food to a younger audience. Mm. And I think they are hoping people will want to cook for family and friends.
And it's been written for various occasions, hasn't it? So under brunch, there's weekend with friends, or...
And there's hair of the
hair
dog.
Hair of the dog, which is often quite a necessary one, yes. And they're accompanied, I think, by inspiring and sometimes quite unlikely pictures.
Yeah.
So there's, and it's quite got an urban feel, which, you know, I love. I just love cities and urban life. But there's a picture in there of a kitchen that I think a lot of us have had kitchens like that. It looks really rather smaller than you'd want it to be.
Perhaps
not bang up to date. But to me, that I just find that motivating.
Yes. Well, this is the thing. They're passionate about East London as well, where they both live. And we wanted it to feel very authentic and to feel realistic and to feel like if you did have a one-bedroom flat or a shared flat, that, yeah, you could do an amazing meal like this. You could prepare it in a tiny, tiny kitchen. Yeah. So we wanted to make it feel very real. And there's a rooftop picnic as well, where they just went and sat on the top of Laura's block of flats in Haggerston. and it looks absolutely beautiful in its own very, as you say, urban way.
Yeah, oh, it's a lovely book. And also, I noticed one of the dinner menus was about foraging as well, and I think that's something which is, you know, good fun, and which you can do in urban settings. There's nettles growing everywhere. And
well, they did, indeed. Yeah, they went out in London Fields, I think. Although, you have to go with somebody who knows what they're looking
well,
for,
yes, we
as
must.
A disclaimer.
Yeah, we must say that. Yeah, I thought a really nice idea for a cookbook and beautifully
yes,
put together,
it is
actually.
It is beautiful. Yeah. Kristin Perra's photography is just stunning. She's a real artist. And I think you can tell that it was a very sort of happy team.
Now, that book, which, you know, appealed greatly to me and so must appeal, I assume, even more to younger devotees of cookbooks, I think it's in very interesting contrast to the next book you've got, which is The Curry Guy, because... I know it's selling very well, but I wouldn't have predicted it. So could you say a little bit about what it's about and how it came to be?
Well, the curry, it is such a fascinating story. Dan Toombs, who is the curry guy, he's in fact Californian and he's lived in the UK for 25 years. And he just became fascinated with what he terms British Indian restaurant food. And he spent 25 years going around as many curry houses in the UK as he possibly can, talking to the chefs and getting their secrets to the point of obsession. And then he published a couple of his own ebooks. So he publishes recipes in the form of ebooks, and they did fantastically well. I think the reason for his success is that there are so many people, obviously, I mean, who love their curry and their local curry house. They might buy an Indian cookbook and wonder why it doesn't taste the same as what they eat at the curry house. But of course it doesn't, because the curry house is not exactly authentic Indian cooking. So what Dan has done is it is very much curry house cooking, and they're amazing. So you know you've done it yourself and you know the ingredients that have gone into it.
Yeah.
And I think there's a huge, people feel a huge sense of achievement. You make this big batch of the curry, the essential base, the base sauce, and you can, from this base, you can make pretty much every curry in the book, and that's how the curry houses do it.
And he fed his family curry for a year or something?
He cooked curry for them every single day. He sort of set himself a challenge, it would be for a year. And then I think it was a newspaper thing found out about it and wanted to cover the story, so then he had to start again after about 2 months, so it ended up being even more than a year. But his children still like the curry, I have to say.
And does he still like curry?
He certainly does. So yeah, he's already writing another book for us.
And when you say he went into a lot of curry houses, I mean, in the area he lives, or...?
He lives in North Yorkshire.
But
he's travelled all around the country.
So a dedicated man.
He really is. Right. He's amazing.
So here we have not an authentic Indian cookbook. But
no,
an
a very inauthentic Indian cookbook.
But a very authentic British Indian restaurant cookbook.
Well, absolutely, yes.
Right. Now, would you... I mean, you took that book on. Would you have expected it to be a big success?
Yes, you always hope it's going to be a success. With this, we had an inkling that there was something special about it.
Because the e-book had gone well.
I think because the e-book had gone well. I think because there's just not anything else like it out there. But also, it's an absolute bargain. You probably didn't notice. It's £12.99.
Now, another, series that seems to be doing very well, because the series is continuing, and it's the Posh series, and this one is Posh Kebabs.
Posh Kebabs. It might just be my favourite, actually.
I spent a lot of time looking through it. It's basically, it's food on a stick, isn't it?
It is. Yes, in a sort of looser definition is, I guess, some sort of braised or grilled meat on a, you know, a bready base with lots of delicious sauces and pickles and salads. So, yes, it covers everything from your classic kind of lamb shawarma to fruit kebabs as well. There are some sweet ones in there. And it's written by Rosie Reynolds, who's this fantastic food stylist. I think these recipes are wonderful. We just became aware of kebabs as a trend. Having this Posh series, it fitted very nicely because the idea of the Posh series is that you take something that's essentially quite humble, like your doner kebab, and you sort of elevate it with these amazing recipe ideas.
Yeah, and there's some really good recipes in there. I mean, there are, you know, desserts in there, isn't there? There's pineapple griddled with lime and chilli, which...
Yeah, that's a good combo.
Yeah, on a hot day like today, that sounds very welcome.
There are some great vegetarian ones as well. There's griddled asparagus and baby leeks and romesco sauce, which I think I might do today, actually. Sounds lovely.
So, a successful series. Is the series poised to continue?
It is. Yeah, the next one is Posh Pancakes, which will be January, obviously, for Pancake Day, February. And then more to follow.
Good. Well, we'll look forward to that. Now, it struck me as being slightly similar, I suppose, in size and maybe in style. C is for Caribbean. Has there been an A and a B that I've forgotten about?
Well, we call this series the Alphabet Cooking Series.
Right.
And again, a little bit like the Posh, it's a good format for publishing into a particular cuisine if we spot a trend. So in fact, you haven't missed A and B, but you have missed K is for Korean and M is for Mexican.
Oh, right. And Caribbean food is popular in Cambridge. You know, there's a street fan and so on.
Yes.
Although not all of the ingredients are incredibly easy to find. You know, you don't see plantain everywhere, for example.
No, you don't. I guess we're very lucky in Cambridge on Mill Road with all the fantastic...
Yeah, Mill Road's the place, obviously.
Yeah.
I think plantain is an undiscovered treat, actually.
I haven't actually ever cooked with it.
Right, well, I haven't much, but it's... I mean, I fried it. I can't remember what I fried it with. It was just delicious.
Oh, wow.
But people boil it and mash it. In a way, I suppose, it is a bit like potato, isn't it? You can fry potato, you can boil potato and so on. I think it's really, really nice, but I'm sort of very much a plantain beginner. So.
Well, I haven't even tried, but I lived in North London for so many years. And I used to walk past endless shops and that sold it. I should try. And there was a fantastic restaurant in Crouch End called Banners that used to cook amazing Caribbean food. But yeah, it really seems to have gone into the mainstream of late.
And I think on a sort of different level entirely, a truly posh book, actually.
Yes.
The Ivy. This is to do with the Ivy restaurant in Covent Garden area.
It is, yes, it's in Covent Garden. Yes, the Ivy must be one of the most well-known restaurants in London. And there's this sort of traditional joke that it serves shepherd's pie and sausage and mash in the most exclusive surroundings and that, you know, you can't, it's impossible to get a table. It is an astonishing place and it's the centenary of the restaurant this year. And there was a cookbook 20 years ago, an Ivy cookbook. A.A. Gill wrote the text for that. And so they wanted to do something that celebrated the centenary but also brought the Ivy up to date. So this book is called The Ivy Now. And so it reflects the changing menus. And so there is a lot more than the comfort food for which they're famed. There's a lot of sort of Asian-influenced food. And more than that, really, it's more than a cookbook. It's more like a biography of the restaurant. The restaurant itself is almost like a character in the book, and there are countless quotes from celebrities and writers and just people from all walks of the arts. In fact, we had an amazing creative team on it who got together. I think they'd first worked together in the 60s, including David Cecil Holmes, who's the designer, and an amazing typographer called Phil Cleaver and the illustrator Brian Grimwood. And it's just sort of one of those things that comes along very rarely and you just think, wow, this has to be an extraordinary, extraordinary package. And I think we did it. It's just a beautiful, beautiful
book. It is a beautiful book. Also, like the first book we looked at, Round 2 Hours. If the book folds out, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's got an open spine and a cover that lies flat. And this is a really... I think it's a concern that lots of people have, is keeping their cookbook flat when you're
so
cooking.
So this enables you to keep it open.
Yes, so wherever you open it in the book, it falls, falls flat.
But as you say, it's just, it's the story not only of the food of the ivy, the recipes, but of the ivy itself. There's even stuff in there about how it runs on a day-to-day basis, isn't there? Things about the celebrities, as you said, who go there. So
I know,
it's fascinating. And
so
are you an ivy regular yourself?
I'm not, and I hope to be.
I think we all hope to be, Sarah.
I've had some lovely food there. So yes, as the publisher, I'm hoping they have a regular table for me in the corner.
Right. Anything coming up in the future that you can talk about?
We've got, yes, autumn books are all pretty much finished, actually.
Oh, are they?
Don't have them printed copies in yet, but yeah, we've got a fantastic cookery for autumn. We've got Rosie Sykes's Sunday Night book, which I think will be lovely.
And Rosie, who's currently seems to be spending Sunday nights behind the counter at Jack's Gelato.
Well, she's written the book now, so she
she can relax.
She can do what she wants. Yeah, I'm really. I think that's such a beautiful book, and it was such a. I've got photos by Patricia Niven, such a happy team on that, and I can't wait to see printed copies of that. And Rosie's illustrator friend from Abergavenny did the cover and the illustrations as well. And we've got a book on Peruvian food. Martin Morales, who runs Ceviche and Andina, his first book Ceviche did phenomenally well, and we're publishing the follow-up, which is, it's Andina, it's about the food of the Andes. It's quite astonishing, and he and the photographer Dave went out to Peru and shot, oh gosh, breathtaking photos.
Yeah.
They're absolutely stunning.
So is it big on guinea pigs then?
There are a few guinea pigs. You can substitute.
What, chicken presumably?
Chicken or, yes, guinea fowl perhaps, rather than guinea pigs.
Right, good. Well, thank you very much, Sarah, for
coming in
and talking about those books. Let's do it again.
Okay.
Thanks.
And thanks to Sarah for that. And the five books were Round to Ours by Jackson and Levine, The Curry Guy by Dan Toombs, Posh Kebabs by Rosie Reynolds, Sea is for Caribbean by Quadrille Publishing, and The Ivy Now by
Fernando Pera
and Gary Lee. And they're available from all good bookshops.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
With the weather being so unpredictable, it's nice to know that good food and drink can always transport you to sunnier climes. In this case, it's the east coast of Spain, with a five-course wine and tapas evening at the Cambridge Wine Merchants, where Matt got arrested for being drunk in charge of a recording device.
Brian, we met back in 2014 in the Mill Road Cambridge Wine Merchants in the basement. We were having a chat with Tom Lewis.
Yeah,
he was teaching us on Cru
well.
Bourgeois.
I remember it well. Can't believe it. It's nearly 3 years ago.
Good to see you again.
Thank you very much. And it's good to be here today at this Spanish event. Spanish wines and Spanish tapas.
Of the East Coast.
Oh yes, from the East Coast, yes.
So tonight we're looking at the East Coast, we're looking at Catalonia and Valencia. Estefania can explain a little bit about the food, and I'll explain to you the wines as we go through. You've got a little cava just to start off with, just an aperitif. Then you're going to have four wines matched to the food. So cava is Spain's national sparkling wine. It's a traditional method wine, so it's made in exactly the same way as a traditional champagne would be. This is by a second fermentation in the bottle. There are about 30,000 hectares in Spain that can make cava. The majority is focused in Catalonia, and this particular producer, Francesc Riscard, they're based in Penyedes in Catalonia, just around Barcelona. It's a lovely blend of native grape varieties, Xarello, Macabeo, and some Barriada, and it's aged for 9 months on its lees, so it gives lovely yeasty, complex, bready flavours, while still being fresh, quite apple-y, quite citrusy, so enjoy.
Green apple-y, they described it as, and yeah, I really enjoyed that. It was like it made your mouth water.
I'm Estefania from Querrico Tapas. As Alice said, the idea is to spread a little bit the knowledge about the wines and the food about Spain. So we are really interested in recipes from regions from Spain and trying to match with wines from the same areas. Because in June, we decided that it would be nice to go to the east coast of Spain I'm sorry for the weather, but I hope that with the dishes today, at least you can be a bit closer to the coast, to the sea, and you can remember a little bit all these flavors from Catalonia and Valencia. We are starting with tomato gelatin and tronchon cheese with basil oil. Tronchon cheese can be sheep or goat cheese. Tonight we have sheep cheese. It's really creamy, a little bit bitter, but it's balanced with the gelatin. And you will see it's really creamy, it's really nice.
Tronchon cheese.
Tronchon cheese.
With tomato gelatin.
With tomato gelatin.
Tronchon cheese with tomato gelatin.
And can someone say, let's call the whole thing off?
You wouldn't expect that of just like a jelly. Sort of.
We actually said initially that we thought the cheese was more mild than we were expecting.
It's not dissimilar to other Spanish cheeses, a manchego or something like that. It was quite hard with a bit of an aftertaste.
A bit of an aftertaste? It had loads of aftertaste.
Then we'll have a escalivada salad with tomato puree and anchovy. This is traditional from Catalonia. Sometimes it's served like in a pizza base. But I have to say, it's a really nice anchovies from the north of Spain. It's really, really delicate.
And we're looking at a really quite eclectic white. There's a lot of up-and-coming winemaking in Valencia and people doing something a little bit different. This wine, it's actually aged in amphora for 6 months. It's not aged in oak or stainless steel, it's aged in clay amphora, which gives this interesting texture and brightness behind the wine.
Escalivada salad with potato puree and anchovy.
The anchovy was a wonderful salty kick, but a long, flavorful, meaty.
Yeah, it was meaty for anchovy. Meaty is the word.
We have a coca with beef and turkey mincemeat. Coca is a sort of shortbread pastry, very popular in that area as well. It can be made with vegetables, with fish. I decided to do it with meat because the last savory dish is a black rice with mussels, prawns, and calamari, but it's black. The rice is cooked with squid ink.
The black rice dish was quite surprising because it was much richer than what you'd think of as like a paella. It was much deeper. Drank it with red wine, which was surprising because it was seafood, so you would perhaps expect to drink it with white wine.
This particular one is from a company called Acoustic Cellars. I'm a big fan of all their wines, from their introductory wines, which start around the £15 mark, all the way up to their top wines, which go up to £40. This is their middle wine, this is the Breo. It's £21.99, and this is actually my all-time favourite wine of the range. It's a blend of Garnacha and Carignana, about 60-40 Garnacha to Carignana. A nice subtle minerality, because these are very slaty soils.
For people who are also appreciating the wine as well, there was a hushed silence every time we tried a new wine, and then the volume picked up again. As you say, the assumption was you do white wine and seafood, but actually with the black rice, the red wine was really good. Acusta Sala. Oh, there we go. That's one we'll have to look out for. Yeah.
This is actually matched with a fish dish, but there is absolutely nothing wrong with having fish from red wine, particularly with this rich, it's this black rice with cuttlefish ink, etc. Absolutely nothing wrong.
And we'll finish with a strawberry and peach sorbet with cava. And enjoy. Okay.
So strawberry and peach sorbet with cava. Was that very nice?
It was delicious.
I mean, it was like a peach Bellini, very sweet.
Strawberries are in season.
You know what tapas means in Spanish, don't you? Tapas means lids, because in Spain they put these little snacks on the lids of the sangria.
Do you consider yourself much of a wine buff?
Not really. I know what I like, and the difficulty I have with it is I don't feel I have much of a memory. When I drink something, I know that I like it or I don't like it, but I wouldn't be able to, in a week's time, say I really like what I'm tasting now compared to what I tasted a week ago. So it's the memory of the taste that I find really difficult, not actually knowing what I like. Yeah.
There is a lot of good wine made in Catalonia. You know, you've got giants like Freixenet, Torres. Torres is very famous, making a lot of wines in Catalonia. But then there are also lots of small, organic, small production people popping up using some old vines. And that's what we're really showcasing tonight, is some of the more premium stuff. Yeah. Quite like it.
The theme for the evening was sort of Mediterranean summer, and actually they've been able to create that despite the fact that it's really cold, really rainy outside after a week of beautiful sunshine. So
how food and wine can create that in quite a damp, cold British Wednesday evening has been lovely.
Very good, very unusual tapas I've probably never had before. And you'd only get them if you went back to Spain, probably. So very, very genuine food and very, very interesting wines as well.
Are you a regular at the Cambridge Wine Merchants Evening Events?
I am. I get to quite a few at Bridge Street and here. As long as I know when they are, I can tell immediately whether I can go to them or not. They're reasonably priced and interesting, and everyone's very approachable and friendly, even if you don't know people.
You sound like you're from Americania, miss.
Yes, we are from the US and moved about 8 to 9 months ago. And we have frequented the gin tastings, the gin club, a few times here at Cambridge Wine Merchants, and this is our first wine and tapas night.
We all have an interest in the same things.
The tranchon and tomato was really good, yeah. That would probably be the top pick, wouldn't it, of the five things we've tried, yeah.
People bond over food. People are happy to spend money and time eating and drinking and enjoying, you know, the nice things in life. And I think that gives people a reason to socialise with people they might not otherwise socialise with, and gives it a really nice community feel. That's why I really like Cambridge.
We always try to do something different every time.
Towards the end of the evening, there must be perhaps 100 glasses. Just looking down the length of the tables here.
Yeah, you look down the table, that does make 5 glasses per person over the course of the evening.
Well, that sounds like a good night. Cambridge Wine Merchants were recently voted the best independent drinks merchant in the UK. And Alice still has the trophy at home because she hasn't managed to get it to the office yet. If you'd like to try the wine and tapas evenings yourself, they seat about 20 people. They last for about 3 hours, which Matt can attest to. Mm-hmm. And bookings are required by calling Cambridge Wine Merchants, Cherry Hinton Road branch on Cambridge, 214 548.
And there's the music again for the latest food tweets from the city. Alan?
Yeah, a couple of places that aren't open today, so don't waste your time going along there. The Plough at Coton closes at 3:30 because they're doing a wedding this evening, but they will be back midday tomorrow. Steak and Honour are also out. Their vans are also out on private hire today. So for your burger fix, you'll need to go to the shop in Wheeler Street. And something that is open today, La Latina Bustarante, open from 12:30 till 8:30 tonight. That's in Tevesham, 5 minutes walk from the Gazelle Way bus stop on the City 1 route.
Now, a fully ripened apricot is more tempting to me than any other fruit. That's from Nigel Slater.
Show me the most wretched apricot and I'll show you something wonderful, says Nazima Pathan as we embark on her latest food pairing feature.
Yeah, and this is for Ruth Reyes, who's listening in Barcelona, having just bought some apricots.
When it's really ripe, it's a floral, sweet and sour. And sweet and sour is something that comes out very strong. You know, you can imagine it is a fruit that as it gets more ripe, it just has such a fantastic floral flavour. Apart from eating it raw, a lot of people feel that it gains even better flavour when it's cooked. So you can bake it, oven bake it, grill it, even on the barbecue, I've done that before, poach it, stew it with different herbs, which we'll talk about. And it's just brings out even more of that flavour of it. Now, there's certain things that you can add to really enhance it. Now, vanilla works well with apricot, and particularly just a simple combination would be grilling or barbecuing some apricots and serving it with a vanilla ice cream or a creme anglaise, so the hot and cold as well as the really nice flavour combinations. Cinnamon also would be a good thing. You could either sprinkle it on some baked apricots, but it's a bit more wintry, or add a stick of cinnamon when you poach apricots. Going slightly Middle Eastern, it's prominent in North African cuisine. It'll be very present in tagines, for example, particularly with lamb. Some people cook it with pork, but that's not really Middle Eastern, but pork with apricot is another sort of meat and fruit combination. But in terms of tagines, the combination of apricot with cumin is another really good one. The woody flavour of the cumin, and it's a spice I really love, works very well with apricot, and it's an important component within Moroccan tagine mix. So that's something that people will really like. It's a great combination. Other unusual combinations, so it goes well with dairy, particularly goat cheese and hard cheese, and sweetness of the fruit will determine what it might go better with. So obviously the sweeter it is, perhaps you can then use stronger flavoured, deeper flavoured cheeses like Camembert, for example, in a similar way to the way you'd eat, have figs or grapes on a cheese board. Apricots would also work really well.
That's not something you see very often.
No, but you know, it's a similar kind of flavour in terms of the floral nature, and it will withstand a strong cheese flavour, so I think it would be really nice. Or even like an apricot conserve, and in fact there's you know, somewhere I read where actually people are putting a little bit of cumin into an apricot conserve and then serving that with Camembert cheese, for example. So I've never tried it, but I think I love cumin, and a little tiny bit of it can really enhance a dish.
Yes.
So that's another thought. And then finally, dark chocolate works particularly well, the bitterness of the dark chocolate and the freshness of apricot fruit. And of course, apricot jam is widely used in baking. So particularly, for example, in Sacher Torte, the classic dark chocolate cake, the layers are held together with apricot jam and often used in many things for glazing fruit. So a very versatile fruit. Not as widely popular as peaches and nectarines, but actually very versatile, both raw and cooked, or even dried.
I don't think that they're as reliable as peaches and nectarines when you buy them. I think
they might not have the flavour.
I think often they don't have the sweetness. But as you said near the start of that, if you cook them, they are just enhanced. I mean, this is something that Nigel Slater talks about.
Yes.
However disappointing your apricots you've cooked them, they will be fantastic.
Yes. Well, it's similar with drying it. It's almost like a dried apricot, but is enhanced both in sweetness and sourness. It's almost, that's why it makes such a good snack in a way, doesn't it? I mean, it's...
Well, they are delicious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right. Nazima recommends apricots with cheeses, different cheeses according to the ripeness of the fruit, and no doubt something Elaine Cusack will be keen to know.
Mm.
And you can find out more about Nazima's cookery by visiting her website, frongleykitchen.com.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio. Now, it's been a while since we had a pure wine feature, and this is because our regular wine specialist, Alice Archer, has been away. She's been studying, honing her wine skills. And now, having recently finished her WSET course, which I understand means well-sloshed evening tipples, Alice has been keen to impart her knowledge of rosé wines, which have suffered something of a poor reputation over the last four decades.
So the modern disdain for rosé wines?
There's been a bad name dating about 40 years back. So rosé comes in all different shapes, sizes, colours.
Yeah.
You can look at a spectrum of rosé wines, and some of them are practically white and some of them are practically red. But it's actually very difficult to predict from the label how sweet it's going to be. Mm. There was a big vogue about 40 years ago for sweet rosé. So you've got Matias rosé from Portugal.
Lunch in the shade of medieval walls on native cheese and wine. Matus rosé.
Hey, 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 Matus rosé.
Bring it on home.
Lancers from Portugal, and also the invention of the style of wine called White Zinfandel, made in California. These styles were very popular at the time. However, people are always after drier wines, and rosé has had a bad rep for being sweet, sickly, bubblegummy, and maybe a cheap alternative, essentially.
Okay.
Whereas there is, in fact, incredibly classy rosé out there. I'd say it's sort of come back, really started maybe about 10 years ago. Sommeliers started becoming more engaged with rosé. For me, it's this perfect balance between red and white. Some people think it's a compromise between red and white, but for me it's the perfect balance.
Yeah.
It's cold, it's refreshing, but it's got those lovely red fruit flavours. It's got depth and character. You can sometimes have a little bit of tannin behind it and texture, whereas white wines you're going to get lots of citrus, etc. So you've got that cold, refreshing nature, but you've got these red characters that make it wonderful for matching with food. I was doing an event in Downing College about 3 weeks ago, and I matched every course. We had five courses of rosé, because there's that much variety and that much potential. You know, one of them was a little pigeon salad. That's with a very deep, hearty rosé from the Languedoc Roussillon.
I really shouldn't be surprised that fashion plays such a pivotal role in the success of various wines, because the same thing happens with food, the same thing happens with fashion, with everything else. It's no detriment that these wines come in and out with the tide.
They come in
And fashion really has been a key driving factor behind many rosés today, not only top-end sommeliers in America making their own rosés or promoting rosés, but also celebrities. Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie have had a rosé under the brand Miraval, made by Famille Perrin in the Southern Rhone in Provence. And that's a very good wine, made by an incredibly good traditional family winery, but it's owned by two celebrities, and that's their instant route to market.
My name is Lieutenant Aldo Rain, and I'm putting together a special team, and I need me 8 soldiers.
And also, it means that it flies off the shelves anywhere. It's got that cachet behind it. It's beautiful pale pink rosé, iconic short squat bottle.
Like you say, it's only in the last 10 years that it's resurfaced again.
It's a bold move, really bold move. Mm. But those wines of Provence, they may not have been fashionable the world over, but they've certainly been fashionable. You know, Saint-Tropez, that's what they all have been sipping for the last 100 years. That's absolutely the homeland of it. And I assume they were familiar with the area and familiar with the style and thought, you know, that's the wine we like to drink, so see what we can do. They do make a white and a red as well, but those don't really come onto the market in the UK or the US. It's all about the rosé. It can be difficult to predict the sweetness. You know, something like white Zinfandel, that's always going to have residual sugar behind it because of the way that it's made.
Mm.
Maybe 20, 30 years ago, a lot of rosés that were in production, they were almost more of an offshoot of red and white winemaking. They weren't necessarily made in their own right. People didn't go out to make a rosé.
Mm.
They sort of made one by accident. There's a method called Sagnier, whereby you can intensify your red wine early on in the fermentation, just draining off some juice. And so you're concentrating what's left with its involvement with the skins, etc. And then you just drain off some juice, and that's going to be bottled. It's already lightly pink. So all the colour in wine comes from grape skins.
Yes.
If you ever peel a grape, you'll see the skin is red, but the flesh inside is white. So you make a red wine by macerating with the skins, and that's how you get tannin and colour and texture. And the same is true for a rosé, but just for less time.
Yeah.
So most rosés would have anywhere between 2 and 8 hours maceration, so just a little bit of time, just get a little bit of colour out there, get some of that fruitiness, get some of that texture, but not all of it. But then, yeah, making it by the Sagnier method, you're really intensifying that red wine, and it's all about making your red wine better, and then the rest of it was just an offshoot and sold off locally, probably.
Yeah.
But that's really not happening so much anymore, which is brilliant. People are actually setting out to make good rosés to start off with.
Yeah, yeah.
There's, of course, a third method of making rosés. So there's maceration, there's the Sagnier, the bleeding method. You can, of course, mix red and white wine together. Which people laugh at this and say, oh, don't be ridiculous. But actually a couple of drops of red wine in some white wine can really lift up the flavours and make a totally different style. It's not legal for still wines in the EU. It's legal in the rest of the world. It's not practiced that often. But the one place in the EU it is legal is champagne. To make champagne rosé, most houses blend their two, blend some red wine with some white wine.
This sounds like a really, really silly question,
yeah.
But you could literally do this with glass and two bottles.
Two glasses. Yeah.
Have you done it?
I have, yes.
Okay.
Sometimes you can create a better wine.
Mm.
If you've got a sort of medium white wine, that it's all right, but it's nothing to write home about.
Yeah.
Finding a nice fruity red wine and just a few drops, and you can create this fruitier, richer profile. Don't do it in front of winemakers because they might think that you're being a bit rude about their wine, but why not? So rosé is actually now the fastest growing wine category, not only in the UK, but also in the US, in New Zealand, South Africa, Australia, and in Hong Kong as well. There have been some excellent vintages recently in the homeland of rosé, so down in Provence and the Southern Rhone. So 15 was wonderful. 16 is just absolutely outstanding. So 2016 rosés, what's coming out now.
Yeah.
And so that's, of course, helping the movement along because the wines also taste bloody good. They're not just fashionable. They really do have character and freshness. They've got this sort of pithy grapefruit thing about them. A lot of them, totally different flavours from what you get with reds or whites, but this lovely combination between the two. For as long as there are good vintages, then definitely they can ride with this.
Mm.
There will become a point where the market's oversaturated, but I don't think we'll ever go back to the days when it was just Lancers or Matthias or White Zinfandel, I think.
Yeah.
We're through that time. You can still buy Matthias Rosé.
You can.
It's about £5, I think. Yeah. It is what it is.
The wine that fits the times, Matthieu's Rosé.
Matthieu's Rosé, the wine that fits the time.
And it's sweet and bubblegummy, quite short, but it captured a market at that time, and it also introduced people to wine. And actually, without a product like that, there might be far fewer wine drinkers today, so we can't be too rude about it. Because really, it brought a lot of people into the world of wine. There were all those adverts, and with its squat sort of like round bottle, and yeah, you had all these adverts. I think Jimi Hendrix did an advert for them or something, and that led people into drinking wine at home, having this on your table, this is what you served. That's really like led to where we are today. Although I did hear that the chap who designed the label was offered a one-off payment or a commission on every bottle sold. Uh-huh. He took the one-off payment.
He clearly didn't have Alec Guinness's business advisor.
No.
No. Oh dear, what a shame.
Do you like Rosie? Do you like rosé, Rosie? Oh, I messed it up. God, I worked for ages on that gag.
I think it was still worth it. I do. I do, Matt. I enjoy a sparkling rosé.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Mm. And Alice will be back with more wine knowledge in a couple of episodes' time. I'm positively amphoric. See, that was a subtle wine gag I threw in there. That one worked.
It worked well.
That one landed.
And time for some very brief food and drink news, starting with a job at the Newnham Bakery and Cafe in Derby Street in Newnham. They would like somebody to work there part-time.
The High Tea Club on Mill Road has started a delivery service. This means you can have fresh dim sum to your door in minutes. You can call the High Tea Club on Cambridge 630 736.
Bill Sewell was on Flavour a few episodes ago. He owns the Michael House Cafe in the centre of town and, after a 20-year hiatus, has been writing his third cookbook. Titled Bill's Kitchen Cookbook, we're told that if you order your copy online before the 31st of August, you'll receive a free e-book edition to go with it. To place your order, just head on over to billscafe.co.uk, and you can also check the Flavour podcast to hear the feature in full.
The Rusty Strasser street food van has returned to the city. It's serving up Swiss potato-based dishes, revved up with secret flavours and a range of toppings. There'll be a regular staple again at Food Park, and you can keep up with their whereabouts the rest of the time via their Twitter feed, at Rusty Strasser.
Thirsty is opening a farmer's market at the Museum of Technology on the 9th of July from the 11th from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Alongside Thirsty's own wines, beers and spirits, there'll be a regular street food traders like Bread on a Bike, Simon Cider, Free Press Kitchen and Jack's Gelato, and in fact many more, along with the new Hot Numbers Coffee Emergency Service, served from a 1950s fire engine. For a full lineup, just go to the Thirsty Facebook page or follow Thirsty on Twitter.
And that brings us to the end of this episode of Flavour. We'll be back on the 22nd of July at noon. And don't forget, you can have a listen again tomorrow morning at 7 and on the Cambridge 105 podcast page or via iTunes from early next week.
But from Matt, Rosie and myself, thanks very much for listening, and until the 22nd of July,
goodbye.
Bye.